Okay. Today, after you go downstairs, the big folks are going to learn more about two countries that have been in the news, Afghanistan and Pakistan. Have you been hearing about those two countries? Yeah. Yeah, what have you heard, Vincent? They suspect Afghanistan for the terrorist attacks. And there are big problems. We're at war in Afghanistan. And there's a lot of work to be done before peace can be reached and before the world can be made a fairer place. But this is work for grown-ups, right? There's nothing that kids can do about that. Is that right? Yeah, there is. Okay, well, that I'm leading into my story because I'm going to tell you about two kids, one of whom lived in Pakistan, and you'll also learn a little more about how many children live in Pakistan, one of the countries they'll be talking about today. Iqbal Masih was born in Pakistan in 1982. When he was 4 years old, his father sold him into bonded labor, which is really a form of slavery. His older brother got married, and the family had to pay for the wedding. And to pay for that, they had to take out a loan. In order to pay back the loan, they had to put Iqbal to work, and all of his wages would go towards paying off that loan. When Iqbal was 4 years old, he went to the factory as an apprentice, and he learned for a year the techniques that were used. Now, many children are used in carpet making, which is what Iqbal was doing. Do you know why children are used especially for that? Okay, Right, they have little fingers, they can make very tiny knots. And the smaller and tinier the knots, the more the carpets are worth and the more the tourists will pay for them. So it makes a lot of money for the carpet makers. When Iqbal was 5, he went to work full time, and he earned about 60 cents a day. And he is beaten often. Sometimes he is chained to the loom so that he cannot escape. And he works pretty much 12 hours a day and sometimes longer. He's only fed from the carpet maker a bowl of rice a day. Iqbal does go home to sleep, but he doesn't have much time at home, and sometimes even when he gets there, he's called back to work at the rug factory. One day, Iqbal's mother needs money for an operation, so she borrows money from the carpet factory manager where Iqbal works. And this money is called a peshki, and the peshki is made out in Iqbal's name, so that means that Iqbal owes Gola, the carpet factory manager, the 5,000 rupees, which his mother's operation and medicines cost. So now Iqbal is a debt slave, and Gula pretty much controls his life. Iqbal works every day and then collapses into bed in exhaustion when he gets home. And sometimes, as I said, he's awakened by Gula at midnight. He says, "We have a delivery of carpets that has to be ready, so hurry and get up." And because of the peshki, Iqbal has to go work in the middle of the night for Gula, and his mother can do nothing to stop the factory owner. So Gula drags Iqbal through the streets to the carpet factory. And sometimes if Iqbal falls asleep or makes a small mistake in tying the knots, Gula adds more to the debt. So Gula is pretty much controlling it so that Iqbal will never pay the debt and be free of him. And I have some pictures of Iqbal here that you can be looking at. Sometimes when Iqbal gets older, he does manage to escape for a day or so. He always does it when Gola is away, and sometimes he escapes with friends. And one way they can get away is they tell the foreman that they have to vomit. And so they don't want them vomiting on these fine carpets that are worth a lot of money. So then he lets them go, you know, to the bathroom or go lie down. But Iqbal goes to the beach and he goes swimming. So he does have some fun. Sometimes he visits his family. But when Gola catches up to him, he then chains him to the loom for a couple of days and beats him. So he always pays very badly for his escape. Well, one day Iqbal escapes for good, and he makes a connection with a human rights organization. and it later sends him to school, and he declares himself free from Gola. But he can't forget all the other kids that work for Gola and work for other carpet makers in the country. And so Iqbal goes around the country and around the world speaking for the Human Rights Organization and making people aware of what child labor is like in Afghanistan. And Iqbal's story is covered in major newspapers around the world. Well, in one of the countries of the world, another 12-year-old boy, Craig Kilberger, was reading the Sunday paper looking for his favorite comics when he came across the story of Iqbal. Now, Iqbal's story was big for a while, and then, as it generally happens, it wasn't current anymore. It didn't make the headlines anymore. A lot of people forgot about Iqbal. But when Craig Kilberger came across the story, he couldn't forget about it, because he was shocked by the difference between his life and Iqbal's life. They were the exact same age. And he didn't know that slavery existed. So with realizing that slavery was still in existence, Kilberger photocopied the story in Iqbal and started gathering information. He went to the library and gathered statistics on child labor. Then he still talked to his school class about what he had learned. And then he started calling kids to his house and giving them information about what he had learned. And then after that, they started doing small things they could do to help, like passing around a couple of petitions to political leaders and heads of corporations, and then giving speeches, and then gathering money. And what Craig Kilberger did was start an organization called Free the Children. And it's a nonprofit organization that works to abolish child labor practices worldwide. And it was inspired by Iqbal's story. And this organization has thousands of people who work in it, who do recruitment, bookkeeping, speech making, money raising, and all the members do it, and all the members are under 18 years of age, and they're all officially kids. Iqbal's story has a sad ending. After speaking in the United States and Sweden, Iqbal went back to his hometown, and while he was there during a time of Easter, the rug factory manager, his former owner or slave master, had him murdered. And he's still an inspiration to the organization Free the Children. But it does show you how brave one person can be and what a difference that one or two individuals can make. And if you look at the picture of Iqbal, I don't know if you can see the top one, he was 12 years old, but he was about the size of an 8-year-old in this country, or even smaller, because he spent so many hours at the loom hunched over and working so hard. So this is a rather sad story, but it does show you that some good can come out of suffering when people see suffering and are inspired to change it. And it can start with kids. So thanks for listening.
School and under, if you care to take advantage of that. Now we have an opportunity to share our lives by sharing our joys and sorrows. You are welcome to stand up and share it verbally, or if you'd prefer, you can just come forward and silently light a candle without saying anything. Mitchie? So for a baby at what age? 6-month-old, car seat is needed. Anyone else? This is unreal. Okay, well, perhaps we're just all so anxious to get to this topic. Ruth? Betty?
I am very happy because I don't actually fix Thanksgiving dinner. I'm going
on. That is a joy. Anyone else? Okay, now we'd like to give you an opportunity to just say good morning to those sitting around you. We are pleased to have Cindy Heck, who is one of our own Prairie members, and Joseph Elder, who is a very eminent person in the community, and I will let them tell you a little more about themselves and introduce themselves.
First of all, I was told everybody, even in the back of the room, wanted to hear, so I'm using this, even though once upon a time in high school I actually was a cheerleader and I could have my voice go way to the back, but I realized that there may be people who can't hear me. Let me say a little bit about myself, a little about Cindy, and then what we're planning to do this morning. I grew up in Iran. My parents were Presbyterian missionaries, and you'll sort of see the edge of Iran on the first map that I produce. I spent a lot of time in India. I'm here in the University of Wisconsin, director of the Center for South Asia, and in the sociology department. And as I look around, I see many, many friends, and I've been here on lots of pleasant occasions. I'll talk for about 10 minutes, mostly on the background of what's happened. I brought some maps because this is not a part of the world most of us have been staring at for the last year until perhaps the last 6 weeks. And I'll provide something in the background, I think what the issues are, and then I'll turn it over to Cindy Heck, who is a member of the group here. Cindy and I guess first met in a medical school project to train residents who could take their residencies in third world countries. And I was brought in as a third world country person, and Cindy is a medical person. And so we started some years ago, which I guess is still kind of working. Okay. I'll try to stand in the same place so you don't keep bobbing your head between the people in front of you. I'll drop back. Can I, off to the side, okay, there. Am I out of everybody's way? Yeah, way to the side, okay, there we are. I'll give somebody a 30-year background because a silent change has been occurring in the American military position in the world that most people weren't watching particularly, but which I, as a specialist in South Asia, was watching. When 1947 came and the countries of this part of the world began to become independent, the control of the oil waterways was essentially left to the British. They had India and Pakistan, they had Aden, the southern tip of Saudi Arabia, and so the U.S. was sort of leaving it up to the British to take care of the seaways. Well, India and Pakistan became independent in 47. The British vacated Aden. Let me point where that is, this corner here, which is another way of sort of controlling the seaways. So the U.S. was looking for a country into which it might entrust the opening of the seaways, and they picked which country? Well, they picked Iran, my home country. I was born just about here. Starting in the late 60s and all the way through the 70s, Iran was funded generously by the United States to be the U.S. sort of deputy official in the area. Large army, large secret service, the Shah of Iran was our ally. And there was one time, we still have a photograph of Jimmy Carter toasting the Shah of Iran, saying to our long-standing permanent ally in this part of the world. Well, that ended in 1979. There are lessons to be learned. When for about the last 5 years of the Shah reign, there was increasing resentment against the Shah, the way in which he was, in a sense, becoming an agent of the West, a way in which the SAVAK, the secret police, were becoming extraordinarily oppressive.
and then through largely what we would call nonviolent civilian resistance. There were protests after protests after protests, with many people killed by the Shah's forces. And the break began ultimately with the Shah's power when he noticed that his troops were not firing on the civilians. They had reached the point where they were seeing their own relatives in the crowds. And then the Shah decided, this was around December of 79, that he had better leave. And so he turned over the country to a temporary government, which was quickly replaced by the Ayatollah Khomeini, a Muslim leader who had been in Qom, a major theological center there, who was enormously popular because he had voiced the protest to the Shah and the Shah's secularism and Western approach on the basis of Islam, Iran, long traditions. So Iran was out as our ally, so we turned to our next strong ally, Iraq. And so for the, so for the next 10 years, essentially we did everything we could to support Iraq. And this was particularly touchy because during the 80s there was a very nasty but largely unnoticed war between Iran and Iraq. And when you actually told the total number of deaths, it was a grim, probably 500,000, maybe more, young men on both sides who died. With no real conclusion, the troops went back and forth across the area, and where those red circles are, where that's where a lot of oil is around that particular part of the world. Finally, there was a peace treaty drawn up largely by the UN, and then came the next step in this procedure, which is Iran invading Iraq invading Kuwait. And so then we were into the Gulf War, and Iraq was no longer our ally. Iraq was now our major enemy. And all this time, what had been happening quietly and without much focus on headlines, the U.S. had been moving its military presence into the area. The fleets were moved from around Taiwan and Okinawa to the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea. So finally, by the time the Gulf War came, it was a wonderful excuse to station major naval units and air bases in this entire area. And this map shows simply some of the major places that came into activity with the beginning of the war in September. So you see the red air bases, I think the three aircraft carrier. There's a very large contingent. This is the first new command that's been created since World War II. It's called the Central Command, and it covers this whole area of South Asia and the Persian Gulf. This is the land we're going to be talking about mostly today, Afghanistan and Pakistan. I want to point to where Cindy came from. Cindy spent a lot of her life in Lahore, which is very close to India. In the next map, I'll show how the ethnic communities spread across both of these areas. The boundary between Afghanistan and Pakistan is entirely arbitrary. This was drawn up on the basis of where troops were, where concessions were sorted out. My good friend Louis Dupre, who was an anthropologist who spent 30 years in Afghanistan, had a famous quote, which I've cited more times than I care. International boundaries are drawn by clods, not gods. And indeed, that boundary is a boundary of no legitimate sort. That's hills and valleys. The Khyber Pass, which is the major route up here, is between Kabul, Jalalabad. There's the Khyber Pass. There's Islamabad. There's where Sindh is. This is now the capital of Pakistan. And then the next major pass is down here in Quetta and Kandahar. And those are the two major points of entry between Pakistan and Afghanistan. This is perhaps the most important map I'm showing. This gives you a feeling for the many, many different communities that inhabit Afghanistan. Very crudely, one could say there's a south and a north to Afghanistan. The south speaks largely Pashto, and you'll see that there, Pashto, all the way along. Actually, in Pashto is spoken also in Pakistan, so you would have something like that area here. And these are people who are related to each other, they're cousins, they intermarry. And so that boundary is particularly porous and to some extent irrelevant in terms of how people move. The ethnic basis for the Taliban is Pashto. And so the fact that there's so many people in Pakistan who are supporting the Taliban is largely because of the fact that they're their relatives. As you move north in Afghanistan, you come to a region where the predominant language is Dari, which is a relative of Persian, and they have various different terms for it. But Hazara, Nuristan, Aymak, Tajik, these are all Persian-speaking or sort of crypto-Persian. So you have Persian over here. This is a Persian-speaking area. The Rabbani who's just taken over the capital comes from this part here. These are Turkish-rooted languages. And those languages simply blur, again, scores and scores of different tribal groups with old loyalties and old traditions. The old way in which any kind of representative government was held in Afghanistan was something called the Loya Jirga. And this goes back perhaps several hundred years. It's not democracy at all, but it would be a meeting of the major chieftains, the major tribal leaders in Afghanistan, maybe 75, 80, 100 of them, and they would meet periodically and sort of reallocate which group controlled which area. This is a very desolate area. Almost nobody lives here. This is salt marsh, primarily. And then these are very arid areas. The only place you can grow anything is where there is some kind of irrigation or where there's a well or a stream of some kind. So as you fly over Afghanistan, it's mostly brown, uninhabited land, except for these little valleys where you'll see some green. And typically, there used to be a landlord who controlled almost all the area, a mullah or a mosque and a school. And the sort of Islam that they practiced was a very ancient sort of rural form of Islam, where the women did wear the burqa, where almost no women ever went to school, where marriages were arranged, and so on. Up in the north, you have these other groups that came in. There was a king who ruled from Kabul, but I should put quotation marks around rule, because whoever was in Kabul usually couldn't tax more than about 30 or 40 miles outside of the area, and then he's running into chieftains who said, forget it. And if you wanted to draft boys, they'd also say, forget it. So it's been essentially a very fragmented area until things, well, it's still a fragmented area. A major event in the mid-70s, there was an internal socialist revolution in Afghanistan with the northern Dari-speaking socialists and the southern Pashto-speaking socialists actually banding together and for about 2 years establishing the Democratic Socialist Republic of Afghanistan. And to some extent, and here they were trying reform like land reform, land of the tiller, increasing the age for marriage and so on. Then, to many people's surprise, the Soviet Union invaded from the north precisely through the routes that now the so-called Northern Alliance are coming in from. In no time at all, they conquered Kabul. They took about 3 days of continuous air flights. And then for the next, essentially, 10 years, there was a war inside Afghanistan where the various different groups in Afghanistan were fighting against the Soviet Union. Many refugees were generated by that, give or take 2.5 million crossed over here to their Dari-speaking relatives, 1.5 million over here to their Iranian relatives. And the refugee camps were the basis from which the Taliban emerged. The young men who are in the Taliban primarily were kids who grew up in refugee camps. Many of them had no relatives at all. Some had maybe a widowed mother. And during the 20 years where they were out of Afghanistan, a lot of the funding for their education came from Saudi Arabia, and a lot of the teachers who came were of the particular Wahhabi Sunni sect, which is a fairly extreme sect. When the Soviets left, there was this power vacuum, and there were about 11 different groups under different tribal leaders that were working against the Soviet Union. As soon as the Soviet Union left, they cracked apart, and then in the early 90s, this group, the Taliban, began to emerge. To everybody's surprise, they conquered Jalalabad, Kabul, and then finally up in these areas here, so that about 3 years ago, for practical purposes, the Taliban controlled almost all the area. But I think the sense of this distinction between the north and the south, and then the multiple groups within them is important to keep in mind. And then just the most recent events. Yes? It's around the size of Texas, here's some sort of feel. But it takes a lot longer to walk across. what's happened in the last several weeks, the bombing began, and these dotted lines show where the Tajiks, here again you get a sense of ethnic diversity. The Tajiks control this amount of territory, the Uzbeks about this amount, the Turkomans, you see the dotted line there, and the sort of Iranian contingent, this area here. And this was called the Northern Alliance. It was a more or less a newspaper term for very scattered groups, all of whom were opposed to the Taliban and all of whom spoke these northern languages. After the bombing started, this was the group that was counted on primarily to move down from here to Kabul, which is the ostensible capital of the area. But again, whoever controls Kabul still can't tax more than about 20 miles out or draft anybody because it's so highly fragmented. So that's where we are at the moment. Cindy, why don't you take over from this point?
Okay, well, I appreciate Joe's background to give people a sense of the history and the geography and the cultural and political complexity of this part of the world. I'm going to be speaking from a very different perspective, and I will go back to one of the maps that Joe had, if that's okay, and that is to just give a little bit of background on Pakistan. I'm going to speak a bit about my own understanding of this region, first as a human being, as a woman, and also as a physician, as a family doctor. So I'm going to give you those perspectives. But I'd like to just add a bit of background to Pakistan. Joe did such a nice job talking about the background of Afghanistan. But as he mentioned, Pakistan and Afghanistan are very closely interlinked, especially along this border, which is really not a rigid border as we would consider, for instance, between Canada and the United States. You know when you've crossed the border. In Pakistan and Afghanistan, you can hardly tell, except the terrain is so mountainous, it's hard to get across. But border becomes almost meaningless because of the movement of peoples and cultures and traditions. The Pakistani government basically has signs posted as you come into the northwest frontier region of the country saying that you're now entering tribal regions. And in these regions, the government of Pakistan has virtually no control. And you're entering at your own risk. And if you come out, good luck to you. But basically, don't ask us for any help because you're on your own. Yes. And that's really the reality of that part of Pakistan. So it's very much a tribal area, sharing the boundary, culture, language, and peoples with Afghanistan. And just a little bit more about Pakistan and India, for those of you who aren't so familiar with the background. Pakistan is a relatively recent country that was created in 1948 at the time of partition from India. When the British left India, the subcontinent was divided into Pakistan, which was a country established for Muslims, so it was really founded on a religious principle. And at that time, it was divided into East and West Pakistan. West Pakistan is now what's called Pakistan. East Pakistan became Bangladesh after a civil war in which the people of East Pakistan really didn't feel they had good representation. There was poor communication because the country was separated by India, and so it was a rather awkward arrangement from the beginning. Yes. So, at any rate, Pakistan currently is a country of about 130 million people, and it's divided into four regions. Sindh, which is the southern state, the Punjab, which shares a border with India, and in many areas of the Punjab, the boundary between India and Pakistan is about as effective as the boundary between Afghanistan and Pakistan on the other side, and that is Punjabi people are on both sides. There's a lot of shared language, culture, etc. And this boundary was rather arbitrary, however, much more heavily guarded because of the conflict between India and Pakistan, particularly over Kashmir. There's the Northwest Frontier Province that I've mentioned, and then Balochistan, which is in this region in the south. Pakistan has been really profoundly affected by the conflict in Afghanistan. particularly because during the time that Afghanistan was fighting the Soviets, the United States put about $3 billion, to our best estimate, of direct military assistance into this part of the world. And so they were very heavily arming the Afghan resistance, most of which was on the Pakistani side. The Americans also helped to some extent to support the Pakistani refugees, or the refugees of Afghanistan that were in Pakistan. And those numbers range anywhere from 3 to 5 million. No one really had a good count on how many there were, but there were quite a few of refugees in this part of the country. In order to fund the buildup of arms that is now in Afghanistan being used for the war, there was a very active program of cultivation of opium. And so opium poppy was raised throughout the northwest frontier of Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. And this was really gave rise to a tremendous production of heroin out of this part of the world. In fact, probably the greatest source of heroin of anywhere in the world. And this was used to fund the buildup of the armaments. As a result, this has created a huge problem with both weapons and drug addiction within Pakistan, as well as a burden of supporting a great number of refugees in a very poor country to begin with. So just a bit of the background of Pakistan and how it's interlinked with Afghanistan. I'm going to tell you a little bit now just about my own personal perspectives growing up in this part of the world. I was an infant, a child, an adolescent, and an adult in Pakistan in different areas. And I'll just share some of my first personal perspectives, and that is going back and forth between Indiana, where my grandparents on my mother's side lived, and Pakistan and India, where my grandparents on my father's side lived. What was striking to me is that people were really basically the same, that we share a common humanity, that we have the same needs for shelter and food and clothing and love and meaning in our lives, and that there are rather superficial ways that we're different, and that there are there's a lot of conflict and a lot of fear that comes out of those rather superficial differences. But as a child, I was struck by the fact that on both sides, my grandparents called my parents the equivalent of heathen. On my father's side, my mother, being a Christian, was really looked down upon. And on my mother's side, my father, being a Muslim, was really the heathen. And so as a young child growing up in this world, looking back and forth and trying to make sense of it, it was really striking to me how there really wasn't that much difference between my mom and dad. They were both pretty good people, and so were my grandparents on each side. But they really tended to focus on what, to me, seemed like fairly superficial things. Who cares if Muhammad is a prophet or Jesus is the Son of God? They're all basically carrying pretty much the same message as far as I could tell, but everybody around me didn't seem to think that way. I guess that's why I found a home in the Unitarian Church. let me say a little bit more about my perspective as a woman. I found as a child that being a young child, it didn't make much difference. But as I came up in the world to becoming an adolescent, all of a sudden I started getting some signals, both in the United States and in Pakistan, that being a woman was different. And I was no longer allowed to enter the mosque with my father for prayers once I was about 10 years old, because as a woman, it wasn't allowed. Although as a young child, it didn't seem to matter. This was quickly followed by my experience in junior high school in Indiana, in which I was sent to the principal's office for wearing pants to school. Even though my brother could wear pants to school, I wasn't allowed to do that. And so it was interesting that there were different ways that culture treated women different in society than men. Although I have to say that in Pakistan, even returning as an adult or as an adolescent in general, the respect given to women allows me to feel very safe in Pakistan, and I could virtually move anywhere in the country at any time of day or night and feel probably safer in Pakistan than I do in the streets of the United States by and large. A few things about Islam and the perspectives on women. My understanding of Islam, and I was raised both Muslim and Christian, so I had some background on both sides, is that within Islam, as within Christianity, there are rights and respects and guarantees offered to women, but there are also roots of oppression, and that religion has been used both as a tool of empowerment and as a tool of oppression. But the roots of the religion of Islam as well as Christianity are really intended to give more protection and right and respect to the role of women in society. The other thing that was striking to me in Pakistan was the fact that so many women didn't have the opportunity for education. And in fact, in Pakistan, about 60% of women are virtually illiterate. In Afghanistan, that was 95% in 1991 when I worked with Afghan refugees. I expect it's much higher now because of what's happened over the last decade. So I really saw education as a tool for the empowerment of women on both sides of the world. And there's a passage in the Quran, actually, that describes the fact that men and women are equal and that the education of women is of utmost importance in a family. And so there's no doubt that within Islam, women are respected and regarded and given the right of education, which is considered quite important. I'm going to speak now just about my role as a physician and as a family doctor, and a little bit about my experience from 89 to 91 working with Afghan refugees in northern Pakistan in the area of Peshawar that we showed on the map. There's a group called the International Rescue Committee that works to protect the rights of refugees around the world. This group was originally founded by Jews who were helping to settle Israel after World War II. But the group has really expanded its focus to advocate for refugees around the world. And in 89, at the time of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, there was a recognition and hope that now peace will be coming to Afghanistan, the refugees can move back, and it's time for resettlement, for equity, and for justice in the society. I was asked and served as a volunteer for a group called the Women's Commission for Refugee Women and Children. So this was a newly formed group just to focus on the needs of refugee women and their children, because those needs are often overlooked in many societies. So I went to Afghanistan border in Peshawar on three separate occasions to meet with refugees, to listen to their stories, to spend time in the camps, to talk with teachers, doctors, lawyers, and the women refugees themselves, to hear about their needs and about what we could do from the outside to help. To make a long story short, the needs, of course, were absolutely tremendous for everything, from food, shelter, clothing. But what quickly rose to the top was the fact that 95% of Afghan women being illiterate made it very difficult for them to move forward and advocate for themselves and to make the changes necessary in their own society. I will say that during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, there was actually a lot more opportunity for women. And in fact, prior to the withdrawal in Kabul, 50% of physicians were women. And so there had been, during the Soviet time and even before the Soviet occupation, a lot of recognition and support and involvement of women in society. The Duprees made a wonderful film about the role of women in traditional Afghan society that really emphasized their important role. So this oppression and restriction of women is really a very recent phenomenon that is not part of the cultural tradition. Looking to improve the health status, education became the key. And luckily, through a few groups in the United States, the National Endowment for Democracy, being actually a fairly right-wing organization, was one that first gave a grant of $12,000, and then USAID, the Agency for International Development, another grant of $400,000. We were able to establish a network of schools for Afghan women in the camps called Religious and Social Service Training Centers. We called them religious centers because otherwise a school wouldn't have been allowed. But it was a way of making the education of women culturally acceptable. I'd like to turn now to what do we do? How do we move forward? What do we make sense out of all this background in terms of the things that you've heard today? I think that the United States certainly has a key role. We've had a lot to do with both instigating and adding to the conflict in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we can have a lot to do with resolving it and to moving forward and making that part of the world more safe and secure for Pakistanis, Afghans, and for people in the United States. I have a few recommendations of things that we can do. The first is the most rapid resolution of conflict and protection of human rights. And as you know, bombing innocent civilians is not necessarily protecting human rights, and that's something that needs to be immediately addressed, and I hope will be resolved as quickly as possible. Intense diplomatic efforts for a coalition government, realizing that a government in Afghanistan is not going to have the kind of extensive control and authority that we think of governments here. Massive humanitarian assistance, a Marshall Plan for rebuilding this part of the world. I think that we could get more security, more stability, less hatred, and more partnership with that part of the world through humanitarian efforts, rather than continued bombing. Involving the women of Afghanistan, there are many women who are educated, who are ready and willing to participate in the rebuilding of a more democratic and just society. And finally, assisting Pakistan, because Pakistan and Afghanistan are interlinked. There's the conflict in India. It's a part of the world that has tremendous needs that we could be assisting in so many ways. So I'll stop here so that there's some opportunity for questions, both for Joe and myself.
Okay. I have a question, actually, for both of you. And when in the first map that Joe showed, it's clear that oil was a major concern of the American involvement. And in the last, in what you said to the United States, certainly, with you, the role of women is very important, but in the last few days, particularly yesterday when Laura Bush was the one who gave the president his radio time to talk about how we were fighting in the name of the women of Afghanistan, I have the feeling that the whole emphasis now is sort of on, oh, what we're trying to do is save Buddhists, don't Buddhists, more stone Buddhism might be there, and we're trying to save the women, and the whole idea of why we're really there is sort of disappearing, and I just wondered if the two
I think you've seen right through the media effort. This was, if you go back and trace why the U.S. says it's doing what it's doing, presumably the reason we started bombing was because the Taliban had been given a chance to turn over Osama bin Laden. They had not chosen it, therefore they had chosen evil instead of good, and therefore they were on the side of those who had attacked the world, the trade towers and so on. And so the moral defense was a horrible picture of cruelty that occurred on September 11th. that those people were somehow linked to Al-Qaeda, those people were somehow being protected by the Taliban, and those people were living in Afghanistan. Now, you may notice we're getting kind of further and further away from presumably the intent of this, which was to capture and punish those people who are responsible for the tragedy on September 11th. And I think what I see now, in fact, what I've seen ever since this began, was an effort to couch it so that the more perhaps sinister overtones are buried, and this is a struggle now to bring freedom to women and get them educated, which certainly wasn't anywhere in the first initial plans to start bombing, or using the daisy cutters, or bombing from 30,000 feet, or just a whole series of things which have been extraordinarily cruel and damaging to civilians. But I think the media and the spin are part of what the whole exercise is. And if one does want to get support from people, you make it into as much of a struggle of good against evil as you can. And I think they're picking up on something which may have some sympathy outside the system. Cindy, you want to say something?
Well, I just like to add the roots of the conflict back to Joe's map here with the military bases. I was recently at a conference, interestingly, with the vice president of ExxonMobil, and he has maps showing not only the future, but projected for the next 100 years oil supply. And I think that this conflict is ultimately about oil and power and control and corporate interests. And this gives us a very handy and convenient opportunity to move into and control this part of the world through buildup of armaments. The other thing that the Exxon vice president showed very interestingly is a corridor. The greatest source of untapped oil for the next 100 years is located just to the south of the Caspian Sea. And they actually already have mapped out pipelines that are going right through Afghanistan, bringing this oil down to the Indian Ocean. So obviously having control over this part of the world is in our economic best interest. And I think that that is unfortunately at the root of a lot of why we're there in such a very big and strong way.
Yeah, I'd simply sort of underscore what Cindy said. If one goes back even to the Gulf War, that was a war that needn't be fought. I think there were clear concessions by the Iraqi to pull their troops out with a few sort of minimum concessions. There was to be a multi-party, multinational conference that would deal with these tensions all over the world. And I did have actually a dissertator who worked on the way in which the White House framed the struggle so that it eventually reached a point where there were only two alternatives. Anytime you hear there are only two alternatives, you have to be suspicious. They were given their last chance. Again, you read that with great caution. And I think one can say probably from within a week or two after the takeover of Kuwait, this was seen as a great opportunity to move an American presence in with all kinds of moral support, because that was when the area became heavily occupied and has been heavily occupied ever since. And one could, if one wants to be just as cynical as Cindy and I are, to see this also was a bombing that needn't have been started. There were willingness to negotiate, perhaps under certain provisions. Perhaps Osama could have been turned over to some court or other. But very quickly, it was what we tell you or nothing. And if you don't agree to what we tell you, then you are on the side of the evil. Then that justifies, and we're sorry about all the civilians, but we're now doing what has to be done. And I think one sees a kind of moral logic coming out of that, which does conceal, I think, some other very important and perhaps less lovely factors that are involved in this.
Yeah. Given the strength of corporate oil interests in here, those aren't going to go away anytime soon. I mean, our economy is the foundation of the web. What are the institutions that are the strongest that we can support to counterbalance that? I mean, all sorts of development agencies, human rights organizations, United Nations, do you see forces that
are adequate to counterbalance or even harness, I guess, the oil interests for the purpose of human development? I think the short answer would be no, that these are extremely powerful groups, and unless one recognizes them and sort of brings them out into the full glare of daylight, then they do have a great deal of power and enormous amounts of money. And I think, well, one, the best that one can do at this point is simply be aware of the fact
that the surface war, which is good against evil, has been framed in a variety of ways which need to be looked at very critically, and that this sort of these sorts of arrangements, which could continue with the same Western powers controlling the area as they have for a century and a half, need to be blunted by some sort of recognition. That's precisely what has generated the dislike and hatred that we've engendered for such a long period of time. So that maybe some way in which I go back to Iran and what happened there with the first serious invasion of Iran by the CIA was when there was an election. A prime minister came in and said, let's get the Westerners out of the Iranian oil fields and let's have the oil fields for ourselves. And that was untenable as far as the CIA was concerned. And Roosevelt, this is not the Franklin Roosevelt we think of, but it was one of his nephews, I think, who was in charge of the CIA operation. And he actually has a marvelous little book describing how the CIA toppled the elected Iranian government and then returned it to the Shah. And then for the next 10, 15 years, we had the Shah as our ally. And I think just being aware that that's the way the game has been played and being extremely public about what's happening may be a way to engender the support of the third world, the developing world, that is ultimately the section of the world that loses when these things, sorts of things happen. Cindy, you want to?
Well, just a comment. I think what we're seeing now with globalization and the World Trade Organization is, I heard it at this same conference by a woman named Hillary French, who's of the World Watch Institute. She said it's as if we have a global Department of Commerce without an environmental protection agency, or without a Department of Justice. And somehow what's happening now is we've got globalization that's corporate driven, corporate profit driven, without equivalent organizations that are available to counterbalance the human rights and environmental protections that are necessary. So what this fellow from Exxon said, interestingly, is that wherever Exxon goes, he's got World Watch and so forth looking over their shoulders, screaming and yelling whenever they're causing some damage. And so I think the more we can be aware of the corporate profit motive and the other things that we value and speak up against those and try to strengthen organizations and entities to protect those, it's quite important. But as Joe said, that the power and money that's actually controlling the world right now is very formidable. Back, Peter.
The whole issue of geopolitics, I first learned about I don't see that things have changed very much since then. It probably hadn't changed at all anywhere in the world. But to bring up a point that was mentioned earlier about the dynamic of what's going on and how we, as citizens of the last superpower, focus on the last superpower on the planet, how we as citizens can help affect change. Anybody paying any attention to the fact that this is an undeclared war? We've never voted on it. None of the issues have ever been brought to the public forum to say, why were there really? We just go ahead and let them go. We let them do it every single time. Nobody stands up and says, hey, wait a minute. We got to declare war first. That's the last I heard the whole concept was supposed to work.
The first radio broadcast I heard after the U.S. started bombing started out, today the U.S. counterattacked Afghanistan. I thought, to counterattack, don't you need to be attacked? And that was sort of the very beginning I had, that this is a queered war. This is a war that's been set up for a series of purposes, and to build in this kind of moral justification when it's so patently absurd. I mean, Afghanistan didn't attack us, and only with this very long string of loose connections can we hold the Afghan people, or possibly even the Taliban, responsible for that particular group. But it's been so blurred and so well blurred that I think most people have gone along with it. And the fact that these extraordinary rights that the president has asked for have been sort of handed to him, including this scary thing of 2 days ago, this executive order, which essentially says we can have military tribunals settle cases and execute people with no appeal, is the most shocking collapse of our sense of human rights that I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Okay. Taku?
There's been mention about, you know, corporate power, and I would like to give you one of your goals regarding the idea that whether it's Democrats in power or whether it's Republicans in power, until we get campaign finance reform, it's going to keep continuing the way it is, and big corporations are going to keep doing what they're doing. Either one of you agree with the concept that until we get the Green Movement strong enough where there's pressure on the Democrats and Republicans, you know, to totally change their way of thinking and have true campaign finance, that then we can change the way things are going over there.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think this is so fundamental to our democratic society. This is something that's long overdue, and I hope we'll move forward under the leadership of Russ Feingold. It sort of brings to my mind the illustration in The Onion recently that shows an oil rig somewhere in the Middle East, either controlled by the Bin Laden family or the Bush family, that's behind this conflict.
Yes.
A clarification question regarding the political ethnic future of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not the only country in the world where people outside set arbitrary borders around it,
right,
and trap a substantial number of ethnic minorities inside, each of whom is unwilling to have very much to do with the other.
Yeah.
And the argument usually is there are important economic or political reasons why we have to hold on to that arbitrary border. I'd be interested in your reactions to whether there are any arguments against subdividing what is now on the map of Afghanistan into three or four separate domains, each one aligned with the ethnic neighbors that they have across the border. It seems like a straightforward solution. What's the disadvantage?
Okay. This is, you know, back to geography being a creation of clods, not gods. To go back 100 years, The reason that Afghanistan was created was both Tsarist Russia and British imperial powers tried to conquer Afghanistan and couldn't. So then this is called the Great Game, and Kipling refers to it. And the Tsarist lost and the British lost. So it was created as a buffer zone. And the idea was, since it's essentially tribal areas, some of it is still there, let's just let them do their thing, and the Tsarists won't come in from the north and the British won't come in from the south. And so it's a kind of a leftover area. And just as in Pakistan, there are tribal-controlled areas, so in India, there are similar areas that just aren't controlled by the central government. They're under tribal control. Yeah, could they sit down and say, let's just go to where our neighbors are? It would be an interesting proposition. My guess is that there's so much vested interest in the thing as it now is structured, with these local tribal chieftains controlling their fiefdoms, that the possibility of their surrendering and becoming part of the Pakhtunistan or part of Tajikistan or Uzbekistan would meet a lot of resistance.
That doesn't have to be a first step. The first step was to allow them their own territory. The New Yorker article this last week indicated that, unlike the past, where people were hungry to have control of Afghanistan, right now everybody seems to have a liability rather than that. So leave them alone, for goodness sakes, let them have their own areas and live.
One of the biggest challenges to the UN at the moment is to try, and this is happening as we speak, to try to come up with some kind of a workable collection of people who can say something leading to, let's stop fighting and let's distribute who controls what area, and then start getting the aid and the food to come in. But I think it's not an impossibility, because this is so different from, let's say, Vietnam, where once the outsiders came in, there was this enormous solidarity, and they were all going to stand shoulder to shoulder and push the foreigners, the French, the Chinese, the Americans out. This is a highly fragmented society and might be amenable to some other kind of arrangement.
One last question.
Ori.
Do you think you have a comment about the children's story?
Oh, well, in terms of the children's story, thanks for that, Paula. That was a wonderful story. And it's very true. It continues to be a very big issue, and it's a complicated issue in that in some families, the way they survive
and eat is through the labor of their children, and there really aren't very many other opportunities. So it's not just a matter of cracking down on child labor, it's a matter of providing economic and educational opportunities for everyone so that there are options to that for people to survive. 50% of the children in Pakistan are malnourished, and that's a fact. And so, and this is true through much of the subcontinent. It's much higher even in Afghanistan. So for me, the real victims of this are the children who are kind of innocent bystanders, but very much affected and suffering by this continued conflict. And that's why there's an urgent need for the adults of the world to try and come together towards some kind of resolution so there's a better future.
Let me tell an anecdote, and then one kind of alternative has been worked out. I've made about 25 documentary films dealing with this part of the world, and we actually picked up on this story and thought this would be a great story to follow up after the kid had been killed. I sent in two filmmakers I'd worked with. They were in Pakistan for about 3 weeks, and they came back and said, we aren't going to touch that. We will be killed for sure. The power structure is so strong that you start coming out with anything that gets too close to naming names and your life is on the line. The other thing is, this is a problem, child labor, for many reasons. I mean, the families are desperate, and if you say the kids can't work, then the family's in a position. But there's several programs that I know in India, and I think also in Pakistan, where the money actually goes to pay the kids to go to school, so they are making as much going to school. Now, don't try that in the United States. I think where kids would love it, yeah. But it does seem, unless it has sort of money attached to it and power attached to it, the kids are vulnerable. The system is so exploitative that there's almost no way to break it unless there is a way in which the kid can be told, can tell his parents, look, you're going to get just as much if I go to school, and in the long run it's better for all of us. And I've watched that particularly effectively with women's education. There are several programs where girls who would never be going to school are paid to go to school, and then they give that money to their family. And this can see them even through junior high or high. But they're tiny, tiny things compared to the economic powers which are working the other direction. Dick and Julie, would you ask your question? Okay. Please.
This is an aside. Dick and I moved to Alberta, Canada in 1960. And as you may know, Alberta is the oil-producing province of Canada. And fairly early then, because they control the oil. The American look was very interesting, made in a different setting, and the American took it. That wasn't what I was going to talk about. Ever since I got attached to the internet, I've been seeing this petition and recently I became aware of an organization, I believe it's called the Revolutionary Association of Women's Education. And I have a two-part question. Are you aware of this organization, and is it a credible organization? Because what my feeling is the petition is nowhere to go. That the condition of women in Afghanistan is deplorable, and perhaps showing people the site may be more effective.
From what I've read about the group, I don't have personal connections with it, but it seems credible to me. And I think the grassroots organization and empowerment of women, Afghan women themselves, is probably the key to making changes. And so I would support any efforts along those lines. And Dick, the last question.
For at least 100 years, the foreign policy of this nation and a lot of other nations has been focused not upon basic principles such as democracy, but on economics. The dollar interests say we want stability. We don't want to keep dealing with a succession of petty tyrants or chieftains to keep our trade lines, our oil pipelines in operation. We want stability. We'll back whoever guarantees us stability.
if you want to run down the credentials of the people with whom we're now allied, a more unseemly crowd would be hard to picture. And I mean, the Tajik group that got in, that now controls Kabul, is every bit as, I think, horrendous in terms of notions of human rights as the Taliban ever were. And we're allied with them. In Pakistan, there's this awkwardness of the current leader was not elected. He's a general who came in essentially through a military move. We're on the side of Saudi Arabia, which practices many rules that we would find offensive regarding women. So we are once again in a position where the people who support our economic interests are in many respects in direct opposition to some of our fundamental principles. And my sense is that time and again, by losing sight of what we truly believe in terms of principles and allying ourselves for convenience or economic gain with people who are pretty unsavory, we do end up in some very, very unpleasant and ultimately violent situations.
To give you an opportunity to introduce yourselves if you're here as a guest or a visitor, and we don't require this, but we like to give you the opportunity so we can learn your name.
And I thank very much for the knowledge here.
Standing in the door, and you didn't hear that this is an opportunity for guests or visitors to introduce themselves, so go ahead. Welcome. And I heard Gemma in the back, too. We're glad she's back also. Any others? Okay, well, welcome to our abode. Now we have a time for brief prairie announcements, and hopefully let's let our visitors go first. Go ahead.
I had a new group that formed to do something concrete to help the refugees, and I call it Mennonite Central Committee, which is a very well-respected they were doing, and they said they're working through the Iranian Red Crescent Society, which is running the camps along the Iranian border, and that they only send what they ask for, and what the Red Crescent is asking for is blankets and food, well, money for food. So we organized a blanket drive October 27th and had got 725 blankets, and we raised almost $10,000. We sent that on, and we're having another drive on December 1st, and Lisa sent it back, and this is one you could hopefully post anywhere. Well, I'll have to turn one over and make a sign-up sheet, because if you give me your email, I can email it to you, and you can send it to more people. And we're collecting more things than just blankets and money this time. We're also collecting kits that the MCC asked for. These are not necessarily going to the Afghani refugees, because they're not asking for that yet, but they'll have it in their warehouse, and they'll send it wherever.
And this is a way that people in Madison can send direct aid. In fact, they're asking you to make checks.
on the Truth Initiative for Social Responsibility, because we'd love to do it as a Madison professor, and we're working with the churches in the area right now. We're going to actually have it at food co-ops over the holiday season to try to get people to think about sharing the holiday bounty with people that have any trouble finding us. There's some opportunities. There's this sheet, and there's on the back, kind of a dainty kind of one. There's a response form, and there's some envelopes to send it directly to the Christian for Social Responsibility. We tell you that we are not the ones that are collecting the money for American Friends Service. It's an ongoing project now in Tajikistan for refugees. A lot, about 3 million more refugees have moved out of Afghanistan during this bombing campaign. Another million are homeless in Afghanistan. So the situation has become worse, and hopefully they'll also open up some aid stations in Peshawar and in Iran.
Do you want the checks made out to the physicians or something made out to the friends or
to the friends, American Friends Service Committee? That's who is going to accept the donations, and we're going to mail them off as a group from Madison. Well, we've already cleared that with them, so I think I explained it pretty well.
Keep those wallets open. This may be your last pitch. I'm not sure who else is here. This is a guest at your table box. Sometimes it's the smallest little activities that you and your children do together that will give them the values that will allow them to support other people throughout their lifetime. One of them is the guest at your table. It's run by the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. And between now and the end of the year, we'll collect a few cents from your meal table to go to people in need throughout the rest of the year. So see me afterwards. I made a little pitch to your kids.
Orange.
Well, I'm not going to ask for money. One of the we were guests at the fair, because we are lay led, we relied greatly on volunteers, and I'm a music coordinator, and I need volunteers to play a prelude with the upcoming Sunday, especially next Sunday, which is completely. And I can't resist putting in mention that one of my employees in our training course is collecting the items that the relief packages. So it is more convenient for you to drop some of the items on the post off in our training course than you have to put them in your box. So she's taking for the future.
Carolyn?
Today is the third fire deadline. Also, the Bay Hospitality Network is still again from December 16th to the 23rd. So it's a hard time for a year to find people usually on both sides. We'll put the board down in the lobby and hopefully you'll be able to find some volunteers. This is for homeless people who get shelter and some Lutheran moms trying to find a home.
Peter?
Prayer and meditation will meet tonight at 7 o'clock here on the stage, and in case anybody's wondering, that's the next
one.
Barb?
A reminder that there's a
Julie?
Brief announcement close to home. Phil Keith was interviewed by the New Yorker magazine, and that article will be in the New Yorker next week. If you don't feel like spending money, check out your local library.
Or online.
Mary?
Chance is not right here at home. We need someone to help follow along dishes. One person.
Yes.
Okay, right after the service, and,
Can we see a show of hands who might be staying for women's group? Okay. Pat?
Some of us go out to one chance to serve, so if anyone wants to go to the drive now, they might see me.
Christy, is that who you are?
Yes. We had a welcoming party
Thank you. Judy.
For those of you who are still sort of emotionally dealing with some of the past, I'm coming in really the workshop here on December 15th to help us work through whatever was in the room. She's a study with New York and she did a service here.
That's here, December 3rd. At what time?
I'll have to get the details of the current version.
Okay, Bob?
Well, I'll have to have the chemical driving train to the hotel. To the rest of Washington, we'll come here on December 9th. It will be a public showing of your four and my other review of the clock. And I'm all in the public. It'll follow the hotel crash and the base sale all in the third.
Yes, Linda.
I'll be continuing to sell you a zip card with calendar number 45.
I think we're done. And I just have to say that during the announcements, all those wonderful organizations that need our help reminded me of that bumper sticker we used to see that, you know, when are we going to have a bake sale for a bomber? You know, that would be the better alternative. Now we have closing words and then a responsive reading.
Okay, please turn to 609. To worship God is nothing other than to serve the people. All peoples are members of the same body, created from one essence. The others cannot stay at rest. Thank you.